The 157th commandment of the 613 is to tell the story of Pesach. Now, when you take a look at the language that the Rambam and the other Rishonim use to describe this mitzvah, it might strike you as surprising how much the Rambam stresses telling the story. And I'll read to you the language, you can see what I mean. Mitzvah Kuf Nun Zayin, the 157th commandment, He should sivanu l'saper, is the mitzvah that God gave us to tell a story. Notice the Rambam doesn't say lilmod, to learn, or lidrosh, to do deep investigation intellectually. He says the 157th commandment is should sivanu l'saper, to tell the story, b'yitzis Mitzrayim, about the Exodus from Egypt, b'lel hamisha asar min Nisan, on the 15th night of Nisan, b'tchilat alaylo, at the beginning of the evening, k'fitzachot lashon ha-masaper, in the clearest, most simple language that you can muster. He doesn't say using sophisticated intellectual terms. V'kol mish yosif b'ma'amar, the more that somebody does something called ma'amar, what's ma'amar? Telling a story, explaining the simple details. He doesn't say, the more that someone is involved in limud, he says, the more that someone is involved in ma'amar, in telling the story, the arich hadvarim bagdalit ma sh'asalanu Hashem, and they go into great detail telling what Hashem did for us, u'ma sh'asulanu amitzrim, and what the Egyptians did to us, mi'avel v'chamas, their corruption, their violence, v'eich lakach Hashem nekomaseinu mehem, and how Hashem took revenge for us, v'lahodoslo, and to thank Him al kol tov shigmalanu, on all the good that He did for us. The more that somebody does that, the Rambam does not say, and the more he reveals fantastically deep wisdom. The Rambam doesn't say that. The more he tells the story graphically, yeah, yoter tov, the better. Kamosha amru, like the Gemara says, v'kolsha marich, anyone who goes at length, l'saper b'yitzis Mitzrayim, telling the story of Yitzis Mitzrayim, harei ze meshubach, harei, this is praiseworthy. V'kosuv shebal tzivu ezeh, and the Rambam proves that in fact the whole mitzvah is telling a story by bringing the verse that the mitzvah is based on. What's the verse? Amru, the pasuk says, "Vagarto lebincha b'yom hahu." You should tell a story. Hagarto, like the word agada, tell a story to your child on that day. He doesn't say, "Talamed lebincha," teach your child. He says, "Tell your child a story." So it's very clear from the Rambam that the mitzvah of the Pesach Seder is storytelling, not limud HaTorah. There's no mention of the word limud anywhere in the mitzvah. So we, who've been preparing for Pesach now for several days, have been exposed to tremendously deep wisdom, fantastically deep wisdom, FDW, tons of it. And so we know, right, how much depth is really hidden in the Haggadah, However, someone who just shows up for the Pesach Seder could entirely miss out on all the FDW, on all the fantastically deep wisdom. So, didn't the Kodesh Baruch Hu know that? Wasn't he concerned? Why didn't he tell us, bless you, why didn't he tell us to learn Torah at the Pesach Seder? Question number one. Where is all the fantastically deep wisdom? Question number two. Once we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, but Hashem brought us out with a mighty hand and outstretched arm and brought us out of the land of Egypt into the land of milk and honey, into a life of freedom. Cherus. At least That's what we're told. However, if you take a look at the physical reality, there are very few people walking around the planet this time of year who feel they've been taken out into freedom. The reality is that the Torah, the halacha, Jewish law, reaches into every single aspect of a Jew's life. It's not just that we have to eat outrageous amounts of matzah one night a year. And it's not just the weeks of Pesach cleaning that precede that. But every morning when you get up, you have to get up in a certain way, you have to wash your hands in a certain way, your right shoe goes on before your left shoe. There are rules that govern how we get dressed, how we eat, how we sleep, how we talk. Really, what the pasuk should say is that God brought us out with an outstretched arm and a mighty hand from a life of slavery into a life of slavery. Where's the freedom? So question number two, where's the fantastically deep wisdom? And question number one, where's the fantastically deep wisdom? Question number two, where's the freedom? Question number three, and this is the main question I want to address today. There is a famous Ramchal which we review each time a holiday approaches. It's the Ramchal in the end of the Derech Hashem where he describes the period of the holidays. And the Ramchal there writes as follows. This is in the Derech Hashem, in the Way of God, chapter 4, section 7, subsection 6. Kol tikun shenitkan v'or gadol she'ir b'zman me'zmanim. Any perfection that took place in human history, any time when mankind was elevated, and any great light that shone in any period in human history, b'shuv tkufat hazmanahu, when the season in which that light shone returns again, ya'ir aleinu or me'ein ha'or harishon, then something like the original light shines once more. V'tchudash toledet ha'tikun. And more importantly, the effect of that light is felt all over again. B'mi shekiblo. For anyone who knows how to catch it. Just over 3,300 years ago, there was a group of 3 million slaves that were sitting in Egypt when on the 15th of Nisan there was a great light. And those pitiful creatures were elevated to become the most exalted human beings on the planet. The entire process took a few moments. And at that point they were released from Egypt and the Jewish nation was born. That exact same light that hit those Jews and transformed them, or at least transformed those of them who caught the light. The remaining Jews died in Egypt. But the light that transformed those who caught it, that light is coming back shortly. It's going to shine once again on the 15th of Nisan. I'll tell you in a few moments exactly when it's going to shine. And our goal is to learn, what do you have to do to catch the light? What do you have to do to make sure that you are transformed on the night of 15th of Nisan in the exact same way that our great-great-great-grandparents were in Egypt 3,300 years ago? Returning to question number one. Why didn't Hashem command us to immerse ourselves in the profundity of Torah on Leil Seder, on the night of the Seder? Hashem's goal, God's goal, is never enlightenment for the sake of enlightenment. The only reason that we Jews learn Torah, the reason that we immerse ourselves, is to transform ourselves. Like the Pasuk in Mishlei says, a verse in Proverbs, chapter 4, verse 13. King Solomon said, Hachzeik b'musar, hold on to musar. Whatever musar is, some sort of human transforming activity. Al teiref, don't loosen your grip on her. Nitzreha, guard her. Ki hi chayecha. For she, this transforming activity, musar, is your life. How could that be? Learning Torah is our life. Doing mitzvahs is our life. Comes the Vilna Gaon and says, no. Learning Torah and doing mitzvahs is a means to an end. The goal is human transformation. This process, musar, is the process of keeping Torah, learning Torah and keeping mitzvahs in the way that it will transform your personality. But said King Solomon, the whole goal is to transform your personality. In the words of the Gaon, Mash Adam Chai, that a person is still alive, who kedelish bor midah shelo shaver et heinetz, to perfect some character trait the person has not yet perfected. And if the person doesn't do this, the Gaon says, Lama lo chaim, then why bother breathing? That's the whole goal. The Gemara in Kedushin, in fact, reveals that Torah is a means to an end. The Gemara in Kedushin, page 30, declares as follows. This is God speaking. Barati Yetzirah. I, God, am the one who created the Yetzirah, that self-destructive, selfish, mean aspect of a human being. Barati lo Torah tavlin. And I created Torah as the antidote. God says, I created Torah as the antidote to a corrupt part of human personality. That's its purpose. Similarly, we find in the Gemara in Brachos, page 17a, Tachlis Hachma? What's the purpose of enlightenment? Why become wise? The Gemara says, Tshuva, u'maisim tovim. The whole goal is that a person should perfect their behavior and do good actions. The Gemara in Kedushin, Daf Tes Amid Beis, 9b, writes, Gadol Talmud, how great is learning of Torah? Why? Shalimud, maybe lide maisa. Because when you learn, you can then act appropriately. The purpose of Torah is to perfect the human being. So you see, the whole purpose of Judaism is to perfect human beings. And the Seder is not an appendix, it's not on the side, it's not separate from Judaism. In fact, because the Seder is really the commemoration and the reliving of the beginning of Judaism, it's when we left Mitzrayim. So of course, the Seder is going to be the most quintessentially Jewish experience one could have. And therefore, at the Seder, there is no room for enlightenment's sake. Only learning for the sake of transforming ourselves. Enlightenment, for enlightenment's sake, so it requires the presentation of material in a fantastically complex way, because it's got to be titillating for the brain. It's essentially entertainment from television. That's essentially what's necessary when you're getting involved in enlightenment, for enlightenment's sake. Now, character development, changing ourselves, it also requires knowledge. Ein am aretz chosid, the Mishnah says. You can't be a very moral, refined person without knowledge, because you have to know what to do. However, you don't need very sophisticated knowledge in order to become a tzaddik, in order to become a great person. In fact, very, very simple knowledge will suffice. I'll give you a proof of this from another verse in Proverbs. In chapter 22, verse 6, Mishlei Chaf Beis Vav, the verse says, Chanuch Lenar Al Pi Darko. Educate a child according to his way. Why? Gam Ki Yazkin, then even when the child gets older, when he grows up, Lo Yasur Mimenu, then he won't have to turn away from what you taught him. Now you realize, according to our understanding of enlightenment, that you really need very sophisticated ideas in order to become a great person. You have to know the Maharal Bal Peh. And if you don't know the Maharal Bal Peh, you can't become good. So really this verse is mistaken then. The verse should say like this. Educate a child according to his way. Meaning teach a child childlike things. Gam ki yazkin, then when he grows older, he'll leave all the childlike things you told him and learn really sophisticated things so that he can become a sophisticated adult. But it's not what the verse says. The verse says, everything I really needed to learn, I learned in kindergarten. Why? Because being a good person is essentially simple. It's not essentially a complex task. And therefore, the things you need to know are simple. You don't need, point number one, you don't need fantastically deep wisdom to become a great human being. Point number two in this regard. I'd like to argue that it's not just that you don't need fantastically deep wisdom. You don't need FDW to become a great person. More, you can't become a great person by exposure to FDW. By its nature, FDW bounces off the human character. I'll try to explain why. Every morning a Jew says, Neshama shena tata b'tahorhi, the soul that you gave me is pure. Your soul, when it came into this world, was pure. It's pure now. It's virtually impossible for you to make it impure. Your soul is terrific. Your soul just wants to do good. It's altruistic. It's sensitive. It's kind. Wants to serve Hashem. Has a long-term perspective. The problem is my body. My body is not so altruistic. My body has a very short-term perspective, and it wants pleasure yesterday, a lot. So the whole goal is to change my body, who is not sophisticated like my soul. My body is childlike. And children don't understand fantastically deep wisdom. Children only understand things that are very, very simple. I'll give you a proof of this from a mitzvah described by the Rabbeinu Yonah in Masechta Brachos. Rabbeinu Yonah, in Tractate Brachos, the end of the chapter called Tfilas HaShachar, the morning blessings, he writes like this. I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan taught in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, page 42a, Kol HaMavarech Alachodesh. Anybody who goes out and makes a blessing on the new month, at the beginning of every new month, sometime after the third day, before the two-week mark, into the new month, a Jew can go out and take a look at the moon. And at that point, you make a special blessing on the new moon. So he says, anyone who makes this blessing on the waxing moon, ki'ilu mekabel pnei shechina, it's as if this person greeted the divine presence. It's as if they met God. Why? Mipnei she'akodesh baruch hu, because God, the master of the universe, af al pi she'inu nira la'ayin, even though you can't see him with your eye, he says, nira al yidei gvurosav v'niflosav, You can detect him through his mighty acts and his wonders. The gum came to Khan, so too here. Because every month, he creates a new moon. The moon disappears at the end of the month. And then a few days later, poof, it pops up again. So he reveals himself to us, and it's as if when we go out and see him creating a new moon in front of us, it's as if we're seeing him, you're watching his footprints, you're picking up the fingerprints, you're detecting him there, even though you can't see him. So, Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz, the Mishkiach from the Mir, so he asks a bomb question. He says like this. He says, I don't understand. Every month, we go out and we make a blessing on the new moon. Why don't we go out every morning and make a blessing on the new sun? I mean, after all, the sun disappears at the end of the day. And then out of no place, poof, the next morning it pops up. So why not make a blessing on the sun every morning? If, in fact, the reason we make the blessing on the moon is we've detected his fingerprints, we realize it's God, where else could the moon have come from? Why don't we say that same blessing or a similar blessing on the sun? So Rabbi Yerucham, he answers like this. He says that all the mitzvahs are there to perfect the child. And the child, the body, the child has a short-term memory. Children remember what happened yesterday. And so they're not shocked when they see the sun pop up the next morning. However, there's a certain age at which a child will not be surprised when the sun comes up the next day. But if you point out to this child, a little one, that the moon disappeared, they'll think, that's it, the moon's gone. And that child, if you show them a couple of days later the moon came back, they'll be amazed. Whatever age that child is, that, Rabbi Yerucham says, is the age of your guf, of your age of your body. That's how old your body is. And Rabbi Yerucham says, we're speaking to the guf, and that's why the bracha is only made on the new moon when it pops back up again, and not the new sun. I'll give you another proof. We make a bracha every morning. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who gives sight to the blind. Now, when the blind get their sight back, it's an astounding miracle. And you realize God has really been involved. But come on, folks. You've all studied Jewish philosophy. You realize that Hashem carries at every single moment, right, millions and millions and millions of pieces of data from the eyes in the front of your head down through the optic nerve and up to your brain, and then displays this beautiful picture in your brain of what you're seeing. And if at any moment he stopped the flow of data, you would see nothing. God only gives sight to the blind. He doesn't give sight to the sighted. Why don't we say, blessed are you, Lord our God, Master of the universe, who gives sight to the sighted? Well, the answer is that the child doesn't notice that it's God who's involved in his day-to-day life. The child only notices when a blind person gets sight. And therefore, the blessing is made on a blind person getting sight. Why do we say, Baruch Ata Hashem, Rofei Cholim, blessed are you, God, Lord of the universe, who heals the sick. The person's been sick for a long time. They finally get out of bed. We make a blessing. Blessed are you who healed the sick. Folks, and you don't realize that at this moment, your immune system is fighting off thousands of bacterial and viral invaders. At this moment, you have cancer cells in your body, and you have these killer T cells and other systems that are going and killing off all those cancer cells. At this moment, he's not healing you. So if that's the case, why do we say Baruch Rofei Cholim? Blessed are you who heals the sick. Why don't we say, blessed is he who heals the healthy? He's healing you at every moment. The answer is that the child doesn't notice that. I'll give you a more classic example. We just finished the rainy season. This last winter, several times, I heard thunder. A couple of times a thunderclap went off very near my head. At that point, I felt like diving under a table, but instead I stood there and said the blessing. Blessed are you, Lord of God, King of the universe, shekocho gvuraso male olam, that his might and his strength fills the world. And his might and strength only fills the world when thunder goes off? Why do I only say the bracha when there's thunder? Because the blessings are for my child. And boy, does my kid notice it when thunder goes off. But the rest of the time, he's pretty much immune. He doesn't really notice. So not only do you not need fantastically deep wisdom to become a great human being, like the Pasuk in Mishlei said, but more, you'll never become a great person through intellectual immersion alone, through fantastically deep wisdom. Why? Because your child can't comprehend that stuff. It's entertaining. It keeps you riveted. Yes? You want to hold on for every last drop, but you won't change. You're just entertained. I'll go a step further. I want to argue not only that you don't need fantastically deep wisdom, and not only that you can't grow from fantastically deep wisdom in terms of character, but a step further. Fantastically deep wisdom carries with it dual risks which could retard character development. That is, fantastically deep wisdom could actually do damage to your character. And I'll try to explain why. Problem number one. Fantastically deep wisdom could create a lazy person. How? Most adults get to a point in their lives when they realize they need some sort of spirituality. And without some sort of spirituality, they're going to die. Their life becomes meaningless, flat. Yes, they're walking around. Yes, their heart's still beating. They're still breathing. But they don't really feel like they're alive. So often what such people do when they realize their lives have gone flat is they run off to get a dose of FDW. I know these people show up. They say, oh, you know, I really feel like I need a chizuk. Oh, where's the hottest shir in town? So you say, okay, listen, I'll be honest with you. You really want your mind blown. Does the shir go right? They show up an hour early. They sit in the front row, yeah? They roll up their sleeve. They get ready. Hit me, man. I'm ready. Yeah, just let IV right in. Yes, here we go, yeah? Right? The rav starts, right? And he gives incredible shir, dragging from one end of the universe to the other, revealing the most deep truths, right? In 10 minutes, you see the entire universe unfold in front of you and then fold back up and unfold again. At the end of the hour, oh! Oh, that's exactly what I needed, man. Person floats out of the shir with their feet 3 feet off the ground, high as can be. 3 days later. Oh, man, I need a chizuk. Where's the hottest shir in town? They run back in. They sit down in the front row, roll their sleeve up. Give me another hit, man. Yeah? Boom! Ah, they're good for another 3 or 4 days. This goes on as the person runs from shir to shir to shir. I call this an enlightenment addict. Yes? And the person runs from shir to shir to shir, trying to feel high. Now, what's amazing is, you would think, after getting so much chizuk, they should become chazak. But they don't. How come, after so many shirim, they're still dependent on the rav to pump them up? And more of a question. Who do you think is pumping that rav up? You think he runs from shir to shir to shir getting pumped? One of the problems with fantastically deep wisdom is that it's like giving someone with cancer an aspirin. It makes you feel a little bit better in the short term, but it doesn't create spirituality. Spirituality is only created by one thing, and there's a secret, there's a sod. Spirituality is created by change. When a person starts to live differently, they move up a level spiritually. And only to the extent that they continue to grow, to that extent, they continue to feel spiritual. Human beings in this way are like sharks. If you stop swimming, you die. The moment that you stop growing, your spirituality drops to zero. So one problem with FDW is it makes people lazy. Because it's much easier to just go in there and passively lay there while the Rav hits you with an amazing insight. It's much easier to do that than actually change. Changing is extremely painful. I dare say it's probably the single most painful activity a human being could ever be involved in. I could never say this, but a woman who I very much respect told me it's more difficult than childbirth. It's very difficult to change. But it's the only way to stay spiritually alive. So problem number one with fantastically deep wisdom is it makes people lazy. Instead of changing, they just become spiritual parasites. Running from one Rav to the next, living off of their spirituality, and never changing themselves. A second problem, a risk of being involved with fantastically deep wisdom, is it makes people haughty. After walking out of one of these shirim, you feel so high. You feel like you know so much. Yes? So you feel like, wow, I'm so from close to God. He's down there. I'm up here. I'll give him the shear next week. Yes? Like, you know, you feel like you are so spiritual, and it can lead to a lot of haughtiness. So fantastically deep wisdom, this immersion in the extraordinarily deep, the extraordinarily sophisticated. So it makes people lazy and it makes them haughty. Now, why don't we have FDW at the Pesach Seder? The Rambam clearly said, there's no mitzvah of limud at the Pesach Seder. There's no mitzvah of learning. There's no mitzvah of giving a drush at the Pesach Seder. Those words were absent. He never said doresh, he never said limud. He just said misaper. Why? So I have a theory, which I'll share with you. At the Pesach Seder, there's something else which is not allowed. It's called chametz. And the Sefer Chinuch, Mitzvah Kuf Yud Zayin, explains what's wrong with chametz. Why don't you want it around your Pesach Seder? So he explains like this. He says, what's the reason, the harchik ha-chametz, that we distance ourselves from chametz? He says, how is chametz made? Shehu naseh b'shehiyah gedola. The way you make chametz is,
you just take some water, you just pour into the flour, yeah. And then you
need a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and then,
it's starting to become chametz. There you go.
You need a little more, and it's less sifner. Hour two.
Yeah, I'm just going to put my feet up. I'm just a little tired here. A little bit lazy. Yeah, that's sort of what chametz is all about, yeah? And he goes on, and he explains a little more. He says, chametz is made b'shehiyah gedola. So we distance this mikir beinu. We want to distance laziness from within us. Yikach dimyan liknot mita tazrizus. By eating matzahs instead, we get a picture of what zrizus looks like. Have you ever seen someone make matzahs? Pour that water in there, pour that in, okay, big. Okay, get it, put it over here, okay, quick, over there, I break that thing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's gonna take it out, okay, over there, here we go. Yeah, okay, now. Next batch, here we go, right, okay. Chametz is made in a different way than matzah is made. So he says, we acquire the meat of zrizus, right, and mehirus and quickness by being involved with matzahs instead of chametz. So one problem with chametz is it represents laziness. Va'od shemati tam b'isr se'or. The Sefer Chinuch says, I heard one other reason why you shouldn't be involved with chametz. And the reason is, l'fi she'or magbi'a atzmo. when you put the yeast in, right, to the bread, the thing goes, yeah, and it becomes this massive blown up thing that looks six times its normal size, yes? The Sefer Chinuch explains, the other problem with chametz is haughtiness, that it puffs itself up. It acts much bigger than it really is. And so at the Pesach Seder, because we're so concerned about chametz, we're so concerned about laziness and about haughtiness, we don't allow anything like that near the table. Perhaps that's the reason why the Rambam was so careful not to say that at the Pesach Seder itself you should be involved in limud or drushes, just telling a simple childlike story, just changing. So, the summary of the answer so far is that we're not involved in fantastically deep wisdom at the Pesach Seder because the Pesach Seder is the beginning of Judaism. It's when the Jewish people were launched. And at the very beginning, everything has to be perfect. So at the very beginning, we want to be involved in changing our characters because that's the whole purpose of Judaism, so that we can become perfect, so that we can become close to God and have a relationship with Him. And since the whole purpose is character change, and number one, you don't need fantastically deep wisdom to change your character, and number two, you can't change from fantastically deep wisdom, it bounces off, and number three, when you're involved with fantastically deep wisdom, you risk, right, laziness and haughtiness. Therefore, there is no fantastically deep wisdom involved in the Pesach Seder. The question that's still left, a couple of questions left, what exactly is this change that we're supposed to be making at the Pesach Seder? We're supposed to be changing our character. We should end the evening differently than we started. I want to make this very concrete and practical. I want you to know exactly what you're trying to achieve and concrete, what do you do with your body to make sure that it's done by the end of the Pesach Seder? So let's get clear now, what is the change we're trying to achieve by answering the second question, where's the freedom? The answer is revealed in an analogy. In order to understand what freedom is, let's compare the lives of two 40-year-old men. One, a slave in pre-Civil War America, and two, a money manager on Wall Street. So, what's the life of the slave like? The poor guy, he's got to get up at 5:30 in the morning. They wake him up. He works like a dog all day, barely has time to get any food in his body, right? Works till 11 o'clock at night and drops into bed totally exhausted. Okay, now let's take a look at the life of the money manager. The money manager gets up at 5:30 every morning, works like a dog all day, barely has the time to eat anything, and drops into bed at 11:30 at night, completely exhausted. More. There were friendly slave owners in America during the Civil War who were very nice to their slaves. There were also people, if their slaves tried to escape, they would have killed them. And there were cases like that. There are friendly employers on Wall Street who, if you decided you wanted to leave your job, would give you your pension and send you off fine. But if the number one money manager on Wall Street tries to quit his job, right, and leave, right, all the billions of dollars in the hands of somebody else who's not going to do as good a job, they're going to kill him. The reality is that neither man is free to do whatever he wants. Both these mans are entirely driven by their employers, so to speak. And yet, if I would ask you, who would you rather be? Would you rather be the Civil War slave, or would you rather be the money manager? Even though both jobs are grueling, and even though you might not, if you didn't have a pleasant employer in either place, you might not be able to leave the job. We all agree who we'd rather be. We'd much rather be the money manager. And the question is, why? And the obvious answer is because at the end of the day, the Civil War slave walks away with nothing. And at the end of the day, the Wall Street money manager walks away with oodles. And therefore, it's much better, right, to be the quote-unquote free man, free being defined as, I walk away with a profit at the end of the day. In this world, you got to serve somebody. The reality is that anyone who isn't serving Hashem is serving their tavot. They're serving their desires, their lusts, their whims. And they're not free. People aren't free to do whatever they want. Most people feel compelled to eat when they're hungry. Most people feel compelled to sleep when they're exhausted. Not until they're exhausted, but then they can feel compelled to sleep. Most people do basically whatever their body tells them. Unless there is some higher source in the world that tells them, don't live like that. Then suddenly they find the freedom, they find the ability to overcome their physical typhus, their physical drives, their desires, their lusts. If you take a look at the name of the place that our ancestors escaped from, it's bizarre. It wasn't called Egypt. It was called Egypt. We could be confused as to the character of that place. The place where the Jews were enslaved was a place called Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim literally means pressures, limits, borders, restrictions. Like the verse, min ha-metzer karasi ka, from the depths, from the pressures, from the limits, from the constrictions, I called out to God. That country where we lived, that culture, it was a place where every single person was driven, and not free, driven to do whatever their body told them to do. They were limited by their bodies, they were constricted, they were under pressure by their bodies to do, and they weren't free. What was the name of the guy who was the king of the whole culture? His name was Paro. You know what the word means? Paru, wild, untamed. He was the biggest Baal Taiva, right? A man completely consumed by lust, the biggest guy in the entire culture. That's why he was chosen. Because more than anybody else, he was wildly immersed in this orgy of seeking after pleasure. That was Mr. Paro, Paru, Mr. Wildness. Now you understand the line that we're going to say at Pesach night, that we so appreciate that God saved us from Egypt, from Mitzrayim. Why? Because if God hadn't taken us out from Mitzrayim, then we and our children, our children's children, would still be enslaved to Paro in Egypt. In English, it doesn't work. I remember sitting at the Pesach Seder many years, hearing that and thinking, wait a minute, what kind of a silly statement is this? Egypt, ancient Egypt is gone. The people who lived in Egypt now are Arabs. They have nothing to do with the ancient Egyptians. Paro is long dead. Yeah, his body, if he's lucky, is rotting someplace. If not, it's, you know, embalmed. Yes, but, you know, the poor man, like, he is no longer ruling over anybody. I and my children's children would still be enslaved to Paro ben Mitzrayim? If you read the word literally, yes. If God hadn't taken us out of Mitzrayim, if God hadn't said, you no longer have to follow every lust, every desire, every whim, then we and our children, our children's children, would still be enslaved to Paro, to that wild, pleasure-driven fiend in Mitzrayim, in the land of limits and pressures. The whole goal is to free ourselves entirely of being enslaved to Paro, and instead go to work for Hashem, where at least we walk away with something at the end of the day. Exactly what does this slavery that we're trying to achieve look like? This slavery which is really freedom. This is heavy. And if you'll just bear with me for about 5 or 6 minutes, when I reveal this to you, in about 5 or 6 minutes, I'll show you how to achieve it. But at the moment, I'm just going to show you that what we're actually asked to achieve on Pesach night is pretty serious. The Ramban in Deuteronomy 6:13 defines what it means to be a slave for God, to achieve real freedom. On the verse, Et Hashem Elokecha Tira V'Oto Tavod, God you should fear and Him you should serve. So, the Ramban writes, the goal is, Shetiyelo B'Kol Eit Ke'Eved HaKanui HaMasharis Lifnei Adonav Tamid. The goal is to be like a slave who has been acquired by somebody who is constantly, emphasize that word, constantly at God's service. Shosem Melechet Rabo Iker. I make the work that my master assigns me the essence of my life. V'tzarkei Atzmo Aroi. And what I want becomes secondary. Ad Shavo Mize, until you finally get to the point. Masha Amru, V'kol Masech Yu L'Shem Shemaim, which is described by the saying of our sages that all of your acts should be for God. What does it mean? Shafilut Sarke Gufo L'Shem Avodas HaKelia. That even when you're taking care of your own body, you're doing it as a slave serving God. And he specifies, Yochal V'Yishan V'Yaset Tzrachav K'dei Kiyum HaGuf La'Avod Et Hashem. When you eat, the goal is every bite that you eat, you should be eating so you can serve Hashem better. When you go to sleep, you sleep for God so you can serve Hashem better. Everything that you do for yourself, and you exercise to make your body stronger, you exercise so you can serve Hashem better. Everything is for God. Okay, this is such an unreal level. This is so far out. It sounds like theory, theology. It does not at all belong in a class like this, which is entirely practical. And yet, in just a few minutes, I'm going to tell you how to do this. I'm going to tell you how to achieve it on Pesach night. Practically, and for those people who've heard this before, it works. The Gemara in Chagiga, Daf Tes, makes this point even more graphically. The Gemara there defines what it means to serve Hashem. And the Gemara says, it starts with a verse from Malachi, chapter 3, verse 18. The verse there says, V'shavtem v'ra'item bein ovid elokim l'asher lo avdo. Go and take a look at the difference between someone who's serving Hashem and someone who's not serving Him at all. What's the difference? The Gemara says, Eino dom shona pirko mea pamim. Someone who reviews their Torah 100 times is not like someone who reviews it 101. Okay, now, this is quantifiable. Look what he just said. The Gemara said, a guy who goes over a piece of Torah 100 times, maybe I've reviewed a piece of Torah 4 times in my life, maybe I've gone over it 6 times, like, I can't imagine, maybe once it was 10 times. Imagine going over and over and over a piece of Torah 100 times. That person is not a slave. That person's not serving Hashem. That person's worshiping himself. Why? Because after 100 he got tired, he didn't want to do any more, so he didn't do the 101st. Who's serving Hashem? The guy who does it all 101 times. Because God needs him to review it. Which means, if less than 1% of my behavior is not directed towards God, I'm not called a servant of God. That's it. I'm serving myself. That is the Jewish standard for what it means to be an Eved Hashem. Less than 1%, you're out! So come on, this is ridiculous. It's impossible. The standard is too high. I can't do that. Yes, you can. Watch what's coming. Question number 3. Practically, how do you catch the light? How do you do it? The Chovot HaLevavot, a medieval commentator, Rabbi Bachi ibn Pekuda, writes in his book, The Duties of the Heart, that there is only one way that a human being can ever get total control over his behavior. There's only one way. Fear of punishment won't do it, because people are brave. And no matter how much you threaten them, no matter how much you yell at them, no matter how much you try to make them afraid, in the final analysis, because human beings are noble creatures, they have this courage, they'll stand right up to it, and they won't behave anyways. But there is something that actually moves human behavior. And the Chovos HaLevavos writes as follows. He says, Hoel ubi'arnu b'shar ha'yichud et ha'chov l'hamin b'lev shalem b'achdus Elokim. Since in the very beginning of my book, I've already clarified that there really is a God. I've shown to you, right? Permission to believe, permission to receive, l'havdil, alfei havdalos, yes? I've proven to you that in fact there is a God who runs the world. Ubi'arnu b'shar ha'bechina. And then in the very next section of my book, I made clear at darkei hahidbonenut b'tovot Hashem meitiv libnei Adam. I showed you how to contemplate all the nice things that Hashem does for you. The Chovos HaLevavos there gives a list of all the different things that Hashem's done for me from the time that I was born until today. So only now, since we know God exists, and since we know everything He's done for us, now we can begin to mention, after these chapters, et ha'chova ha'mutelet ala adam, the obligation that rests upon a person, keshetovot ela b'ruot lo, when it's very clear to him all these good things that have been done for him. V'hi kabalat avodas Elokim. This is called accepting avodas Elokim, right? The slavery, the working for, right? Being a servant to God. So what do you see? You see, the only way to actually get to a point where you can give everything about you, every part of your personality over to God, is if you have a karas hatov, if you have appreciation for what He's done for you. That's the only way. Nothing else will do the job. How do you get that? So Rav Yisrael Salanter spells it out. He says there's two concrete things you've got to do. First, in the Or Yisrael, Michtav Tes, Rishon Lezion says like this, "My derech haklali liknot midos." What is the general way that someone goes about acquiring character traits? How do you change a character? He says, "Harchavat dvarim hanodim l'kol." What we should do is take something that everybody knows about. The Jews got out of Mitzrayim, and open that concept up. Achein lo b'yediatam yusar ha'adam. But not through intellectual opening up of the concept will you actually be changed. Only if you open it up in such a way that you're emotionally moved, we actually change. What you do is, you create for yourself real pictures, graphic images, of the things that were done for you. And when you can see these graphic pictures in front of you, so then you'll feel such appreciation, you'll actually change. Now you understand this crazy minig many Jews have, that halfway through the Seder, they pick up the matzahs, and they put them on their shoulder, and they go marching around the room. We were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and he carried matzahs on our shoulders when he left Egypt. What kind of a crazy thing is this? Why do we have a shank bone sitting there on the table? Why can't we just describe intellectually the symbolism that the shank bone really represents, right? This midah, this sphera, which sends energy through this way. And why don't we do that? Why a real live shank bone sitting there? Why maror? That it should be bitter in our mouth. And it's got to be bitter or you're not yotzi. You can't use applesauce for maror. Why does it have to be that you use something that looks like mortar, right? Just like the stuff they built the bricks with. What's that all about? Why the pictures? The minhagim of the Jews are kadosh. And this minig that we have, to have graphic illustrations of the Pesach Seder, that's the minimal level that you need in order to achieve hakaras hatov, appreciation, to actually change. There's people who are mahadir with this mitzvah. They go a little further. I've been to a Pesach Seder where when they get to the 10 plagues, you know those, what are those things called that the guy walks out with at the ball game carrying the Coca-Colas or the hot dogs? You know, he has it around a tray, but it's like a tray that hangs on his shoulders. What's that called? Anyway, at my Pesach Seder, every year, we're about to start with the plagues and we do Dom, and then suddenly the kitchen door swings open and some guy walks out, "Who wants water? Who wants water?" And the person walks up to each person at this Pesach Seder and says, "Are you a Jew or a Mitzri?" So the person says, "I'm a Jew." He hands him a cup of water. If he says, "I'm a Mitzri," he hands him a cup of tomato juice. I'm sure you've all been to Siddurim where they have plastic frogs. Yes, all over the table. Yes, right? At our Pesach Seder last year, my kids built a Yam Suf. And halfway through the Seder, we're singing, "Die, die, Einu, die, die, Einu." Right? I'm dressed up like Paro. We all stand up, yes? Right? And everyone gets up and they all start marching, right? And we all march towards the Yam Suf, right? I switch hats, put on my Moshe Rabbeinu hat, grab the stick. We go through the tunnel that says, "For Levim only and their guests," yes? Right? Walk through the tunnel. There's fish hanging on both sides. Right? You can see right through the tunnels, right? That's what it's supposed to be like. Tziure Chush. Now, if this sounds silly, so you should know that people probably also laughed at Rabbi Chanina when he used to go out to greet the Shabbos Malka. And they probably also laughed at Rabbi Yanai when, as Shabbos was coming in, he would bow and he would say, "Boi kala, boi kala." But that's the way that you change. You change through tzirim, through pictures. Through those pictures, feeling the Hakar Satov. And because you feel the Hakar Satov, then you can change. Now, Rishus Salanter points out there's a second thing you can do to heighten the effect. Besides having these visual pictures, the Pesach props, so to speak. So Rishus Salanter says that another way to feel a karsa tov, to drive this feeling into your heart, is like this. Tov lachzor ma'amar hayira v'hamusar kama pamim. He says you should take something that communicates that message that you want to internalize and go over it many, many, many times. Don't just read it once, but after you've read it once, read it a second time and a third time. U'b'yichud kashir yagila ezim ma'amar chazal, especially when you get to some passage that perfectly encapsulates, that represents that thing that you're trying to internalize. Yachzor v'yishana elav b'itpalus kama v'kama pamim. Keep saying it over and over and over again until you start to feel emotionally moved. If you start to cry, beautiful. That's so much the better. So it's interesting. This is exactly the advice that's brought down in Shulchan Aruch. You don't have to be too creative to realize this is exactly what we're supposed to be doing right now. In Or HaChaim, Siman Tav Lamed, Sif Aleph, there in the Ramah, the Ramah says, "V'minig lomar b'mincha shel Shabbos HaGadol." There's a custom, minimally, that at Shabbos HaGadol, which is right before Pesach, you say, "Mitchilas avadim hayinu ad likfor akol avonoseinu." You start saying over part of the Pesach Seder. You actually go through the words of the Pesach Seder, learning through the Haggadah. So, what you see is that the night of the Pesach Seder should not be the first time that you see the Haggadah. If you want to catch the light, you absolutely must review the entire Pesach Haggadah now. If you're interested in learning, learn now. But I'll recommend a unique type of limud. Instead of, at this point it's a little bit late because Pesach is almost upon us, instead of going through the fantastically deep wisdom in many of these very, very sophisticated Haggadahs, what I recommend is go through a Haggadah which does exactly what the Rambam says the mitzvah is on the Pesach, at the Pesach Seder, which goes into great detail about the story, which fills in all the midrashim. And if you have trouble finding such a Haggadah, thank God we live in a day when there's a lot of Jewish publishing, go and get a copy, you can get it in English, of the Midrash Says. And just go through Parshas Bo, B'Shalach, Yisro, in the Midrash Says, seeing exactly what happened. if you have more sophisticated skills, actually sit down and learn the Medrash. And learn up all the crazy stories of what took place during the plagues, during the Exodus, when they got to the Yam Suf. Get all the details under your belt. And then when you're sitting at the Pesach Seder and you're reading through the Haggadah again, maybe your third or fourth time already, you have these pictures in your head of exactly what took place at every point in the story. So practically, I'm recommending two things. Number one, that you use props. Number two, and you get into those props and really try to feel like you are the one who's leaving Mitzrayim. Number two, that you review the Pesach Haggadah many, many times. And now finally, number three, and this is the bomb. You have to have achieved Hakaras HaTov, an overwhelming sense of appreciation and love for Hashem because of all that He's done for you, by the time when the light shone 3,300 years ago. The light shone precisely, the whole thing lasts for a split second. If you could hear the light, it would sound like this. Bzz. That's it. You've got to catch it in that second. The light shone 3,300 years ago. I'll tell you exactly when during the Pesach Seder. It shines at halachic chatzos, at halachic midnight. I didn't bring in a calendar today to tell you exactly what time halachic midnight is, but it's very easy to check. Just get a hold of a luach, a Jewish calendar. It will tell you exactly when halachic midnight is. That's the time that you're supposed to eat the afikoman by. At that point, when the light shines, right, you want to be in a state of Hashem. I love you so much for everything you've done for me and for my parents and for my grandparents, my great-grandparents, going back through the 3,300 years of ancestors that brought me to this point today. You want to be so overwhelmed. You ideally tears flowing down your face. You want to be completely consumed with a Hakaras HaTov for a split second. Just target that split second. And then what you want to feel as the light shines during that split second is, and Hashem, in this moment, I just want to do whatever you ask. 100% avdus, real slavery, which is really freedom. If for a split second, at Chatzos, on Pesach night at Lel Seder, you can feel that appreciation and move it into, Hashem, I just want to serve you. You will catch a light that will transform you and you will never be the same person again. There are a lot of different types of children at the Pesach Seder who need a geula, who need to be redeemed. We spent the last hour talking about how we're going to get our redemption, so to speak, at the Pesach Seder, practically exactly what to do. I just want to conclude by pointing out that there's a child at the Pesach Seder who doesn't even know how to ask. In fact, there's many children who so don't know how to ask, they don't even know how to get to a Pesach Seder. And there will be millions, unfortunately, millions of our relatives who will need to be at a Pesach Seder this year, who, God forbid, might not make it. But we're all connected. We're sewn together into a net. And if we are willing to do the work, if we're willing to learn through the Haggadah, and we're willing to use the props, and we're willing to work up the Hakaras HaTov, and we're willing to sit there at the moment of Chatzos and try to feel, yes, Hashem, I just want to do everything you ask. If we're willing to do that, then we'll lift ourselves up. And we'll lift up all of our relatives across the world who don't even know what to ask. And B'siyata Dishmaya, this year, through our efforts and God's kindness, we will achieve a Geula Shlema.